Behind the Knife, the surgery podcast, where we take a behind-the-scenes, intimate look at surgery from leaders in the field.
So welcome, everybody, to another episode of Behind the Knife. We're going to jump right in here today. And tonight, we're going to talk a little bit about the whole applicant process in terms of residency and fellowship. Tonight we have joining us Dr. Howard Ross, who is the Vice Chairman of Clinical Affairs and a Professor in Chief of the Division of Colorectal Surgery. And he's also the Program Director for the General Surgery Residency at Temple University in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. Howard, thanks for joining us.
Sure, Scott.
We also have Dr. Bradley Champagne, who's an Associate Professor of Surgery. He's also the DHI Chair on the West Side for University Hospitals. And Brad's also looking at it from a little bit different process, and he's the program director for the Fellowship of Colorectal Surgery at University Hospitals Case Western Reserve Medical Center here in Cleveland, Ohio. Brad, welcome Behind the Knife.
Thanks, Scott. Happy to be here.
So, fellas, again, thanks so much for taking the opportunity to kind of join us. And what we want to do is we want to talk a little bit about the residency and the fellowship application process and kind of try to debunk some of the myths. And I guess we got John and Kevin with us, and we all know that some of these questions that we're going to talk about might differ from institution to institution or program director to program director, but there's certain generalizations that definitely come up amongst all the different things, and so we kind of want to delve right in. So Howard, I'll start with you. So applying to various programs these days, it just seems like with the online ARIS and everything like that, it seems like anybody can apply to all sorts of different programs. But with interviews, if you get called to another interview, how many should you actually accept? How many should you go to? Should you reach to ones? Should you have safety schools? And how honest do you think that candidates really are with themselves about getting into this process?
Yeah, that's actually an excellent question and quite complex. The number of programs one should apply to really depends on the field that they're applying for, how competitive it is, how competitive they are. So there's no easy number or a number that I can give you. I would say, though, that it's important to seriously assess your own abilities, interests, and scores. If you're an outstanding applicant to residency, meaning you are AOA or have excellent Part 1s or really specific to any field, you're very well qualified, then you can be a little bit more selective as where you apply. But clearly you have to apply to a range of programs no matter what. And you really have to think about where you're applying because you don't want to waste your own time. You'll only be able to go to so many interviews. The interviews are expensive. And really, I think a lot of forethought should go into the application process before you even decide where you're going to apply.
Brad, does it change at all with fellowship? Or what, kind of what advice do you give along the same lines?
Yeah, I'd echo a lot of the similar sentiments to Howard. I think that most importantly, as Howard alluded to, is to know yourself. So you have to know how qualified you are as an applicant, and you have to get an honest answer about that from your program director or the mentors that are writing the letters of recommendation. So after you've done that, that helps you understand how many programs that you should apply to. For fellowship, irregardless of what the subspecialty is, you're going to apply to less programs, and you're going to probably have a more narrow focus if you're a highly qualified applicant. If you're in the middle of the pack, you're probably going to cast a larger net, and that's important. In regards to which programs, I think it's important to know whether you have geographic limitations or you'll really go anywhere for the best training, to get to the next step.
Mm-hmm.
The last point on that is your fellowship will also help you in the next level getting the ideal job that's going to be the best fit. So with fellowship, some places are more academically based, some are more community or private based. And so, again, try to understand who you are and what your maybe long-term goal is for a job and see which programs have had success in landing fellows into those jobs.
I just wanted to expand on something that Dr. Champagne just said, really two things. The first is best training, because best is really dependent upon what your goals are. And I think it's very, very important, as we both kind of touched on, to really put some thought into what you're about and knowing what you really want in your life. If you're dead set on academics, if you really want to end up in the community, each of those things are great goals in and of themselves, but different programs will prepare you for different careers, some and better than others. So putting thought into what you're about is probably the first and most important step in the entire application process.
Yeah, and for fellowship, you know, assuming it's a 1 or 2 year process, it's a short time. So I would really ask yourself why you have geographic limitations and how serious you are about those, and compromise that if you can for an ideal fit.
I guess the first question that always comes up when we, you know, you're looking to apply to residency or fellowship is, am I going to fit into the, you know, the score cutoffs for everything? You know, how important are your, you know, for residency are your STEP scores, and then for fellowship and more your ABSITE scores?
For all programs, they generally use scores as a screen. One of the things that I would suggest is to think about the program, what the tradition of the institution where the program's located, and then make some decisions from there. I would also emphasize that once you get the interview, really that score screen no longer matters. So it's really going to be about how you present yourself and how you carry yourself that day, and trying to determine best whether you think the institution fits you and how you might fit into the culture that's there, because every institution has its own culture. So there are some screens. I would say that all institutions probably break those numbers as well, depending on the entire application process. So I would apply broadly and seriously assess your qualifications even before you start the process.
Is there anywhere that you can find the screening scores for different institutions, or is that kind of kept quiet?
Yeah, I think it would be a difficult number to come up with.
Yeah, I'd agree from a fellowship standpoint that, of course, it depends on the program, but that's a very effective screening process. So it depends on how competitive fellowships are. Whenever there's more applicants, which seems to be the day in the era of everyone does a fellowship, there's more applicants than spots available. That's a very easy screening tool. I think that Howard made a great point. Once you hit that tool and you get an interview, it's a little bit of a wash. I don't think any of us program directors, and we sit around and we do talk about this stuff a lot, at the end of the day are going to say, well, we can't really distinguish between these two applicants. You know, one's the 85th percentile, one's the 68th percentile. We're going to go to applicant B. We'll actually just start doing more homework and making phone calls to different people that wrote letters, trying to learn as much as we can about those individuals to see if they're a good fit, rather than marginalize them by 10, 12, 15% difference.
Dr. Ross, one question I remember that was brought up a lot as a med student is, you know, I bombed step one, but I'm going to make it up on step two and blow it away. Does that sort of thing make a difference? Do you appreciate that when students apply with those?
Yeah, I can only speak to our institution with definitive evidence, but we look at the entire package and we certainly take into account improvements in any realm, such as scores between second year clinical performances, step one, step two. We're really trying to look for the person who's going to fit at our institution and pick that person from the entire package that they present.
So let's jump ahead and just talk a little bit about now it's time to kind of prepare your package, and specifically to kind of prepare what you're going to send in and what you're going to talk about. Now, we'll start off with a personal statement. It's something I can remember I struggled a lot with, and, you know, how do I make myself unique? And, you know, I always was like everybody's going to say I'm hardworking and I'm a team player. And so, Brad, talk to me a little bit about the personal statement. Is there some do's and some don'ts? Is that good English? Are there some do's and don'ts with regards to the personal statement?
Yeah, so I think that personal statement for most of us, and certainly at fellowship level, it's a little more exclusive, but personal statements, after we start to read, and I start to read in more detail, when we kind of have four or five individuals we're trying to separate, you know, from at least in our experience. And I think a lot of people are like that. There's so much. There's a lot of other information, and letters of recommendation are of great value. But there are, I would say that if you're unsure and you're going to go a little bit, you know, outside the box with your personal statement, and you know, better off being a little bit safe from that standpoint, because you know, they meet you, the program directors and the faculty are going to meet you for 15 or 20 minutes in a room, and they may not know you that well personally. And if you put something too esoteric or bizarre in your personal statement, you don't know how someone else is going to interpret it. So I think just keep it simple. Don't agonize over it. And just kind of carefully articulate and sincerely why you're into that profession. I think that's the best way. I think the big turnoffs would be grammar. Grammar mistakes, spelling mistakes, and having a two- or three-page narrative, you know, different life stories would be on the don't list.
So, Howard, I shouldn't put I want to be a surgeon and do general surgery residency at Temple because I like to cut people?
I would say that the personal statement is one of the critical portions of an application. I learned a tremendous amount about the applicant from that statement. I think it's more important to be true to yourself than try to make yourself unique or something that you're not. But I get information about your motivation for your field, for the field, preparation for the field and the application process. It's often a jumping off point for interview questions. So I couldn't emphasize more the importance of the personal statement. And I think it's just important to let the reader know what you're about. I would also agree with Brad that good judgment is clearly important. I wouldn't share things that you wouldn't be comfortable sharing with the public or might be incredibly sensitive, but a personal, meaningful story about yourself and why you want to be a surgeon, or if it's a subspecialty, why you want to do that specialty, how you came about it. I find them very meaningful. It also helps me remember the applicant when it comes time to rank for them after the interview process is complete. So I would put serious thought into what goes into that personal statement. And like Brad said, you know, clearly punctuation mistakes show lack of preparation, and we interpret that as lack of care, and it carries into how you're going to present yourself. So that personal statement is critically important, and I can't place enough emphasis on it.
What about
I guess one of the things, and I'm sorry, John, for cutting you off, but I guess I will always remember one of my very first years as staff reading through some of these personal statements or CVs and having people lie on them. And the famous one was somebody who said they were in the Seoul Olympics.
Yeah.
You know, it actually happened. They said they were in a judo in the Seoul Olympics. I forget if it was the Junior Olympics or not, but in this era of Google or Bing or whatever you want to, that is so easy to vet those things out, especially a bold statement like that. No, one needs to look no further than any number of sports teams, whether it be Notre Dame's coach, George O'Leary, or some of these other guys that kind of put these kind of myths or half-truths on the on their personal statement, on their CVs. That stuff is easy to find out.
Yeah, that's a great point. And the other thing I would say is be prepared to discuss anything that's in that statement. So if you start talking about research or your research or your role in a research project and you're asked about it and you can't explain it, that makes it less incredible. So please be careful in what you write and know the content matter about it.
What about as a medical student playing the residency, putting in your, you know, interests in future careers, such as self-specialization, things like that. Something I thought about when I was writing mine. What are your thoughts on that?
I think it's great. I really want to know what you're about. So if you have a particular reason to want to become a pediatric surgeon or colorectal surgeon or cardiac surgeon, I'm more than happy to hear about it. I think all residency program directors and people involved in residency education know that you have the right to change your mind. In fact, I would challenge you that you're not doing an appropriate job in residency if you're not constantly challenging yourself as to where you fit in best in the world of surgery. So we take that as an important piece of what you say, but it's more, it helps me get to know what you're about. It doesn't preclude you. We're not looking for vascular surgeons or subspecials in any particular area, but if you say that you're interested in it, I'd like to know why. It also may help us tailor your interview process, such as there's a dinner or a lunch and you said you want to be a vascular surgeon, I may make greater effort to introduce you to one of our vascular team. So we can use that point to help you have a better day.
Another area that stresses both medical students and residents out is determining who to ask recommendation letters from and, you know, what do they mean? And it's kind of a different question, I feel like, for the med students applying into general surgery versus residents applying into fellowship. But how important is it to get them from surgeons? How important is it to have it from the program director of surgery at your own institution? And what are your thoughts on recommendation letters?
So I think, let's start with fellowship. I think it's critical to emphasize that a great letter of recommendation, you know, from a less known surgeon without a national reputation is much better than a soft or mediocre letter from a national figure. That'll really hurt your application. It's somebody that might be well-respected, somebody that you know, and someone that you work with at a national level or through other committees. And if they're just writing a letter, you can tell to write a letter, you know, that's not a strong endorsement on your behalf. So the first thing is identifying, you know, those people around you in residency, they're going to write strong letters. And I would actually take it a step further and I would ask them, you know, I would ask them if they would be happy writing a strong letter of endorsement for you for a fellowship. That's how I would, where a lot of people say yes to write a letter, and it's very surprising what comes into those letters. And the letter of recommendation, in my opinion, and at least for fellowships, and a lot of them, are probably the most important thing, you know, in your application. So you have to be very careful who you select. A couple other generalizations, you know, on that are, if you're applying to, I'll just use colorectal, but you know, use the same for cardiothoracic, you know, et cetera. So you're a general surgery resident and you want to go into colorectal surgery, and you're coming from a general surgery program where there are colorectal surgeons and people know those colorectal surgeons, and you have no letters from those colorectal surgeons, that's a red flag. And, it, you know, it sounds obvious, but we see those applicants every year. Either, you know, you haven't strived to work around those people enough for them to know you, or they don't like you. But either way, that's a huge red flag, and you may not even get in. You may have 95 percentile on your app site and might be in a good screening pile, but you might not come, you know, because of that reason. It might be in this era of instant communication, quick text message to a friend, all the program directors know each other, all the colorectal and fellowship surgeons know each other, quick text, quick email, hey, so-and-so applying from your program, we haven't heard from them. And usually the text or the email, or we haven't heard from you, a text or email response back is almost always, there's a reason so-and-so, he or she, does not have a letter from me. And there's no interview that's going to come from that. So find great letters. The last thing I'll say, ideally, you can get a mix of great letters from, you know, people maybe that aren't known as well, and then very good letters or great letters from your chair or, you know, the subspecialist in your institution.
Yeah, from the general surgery applicant perspective, I think it's always better to have a letter from someone that knows you well. A strong letter is clearly what you want. You don't want any average letters. You usually will have a letter from your chairman or your residency program director, that would be expected. So it's important to try to get to know them and maybe schedule an appointment with them if you haven't worked at the main institution or you don't know them well. All of the program directors and chairs will be glad to meet with you and discuss what your goals in surgery are and how they can help you. Interesting thoughts are letters from outside the field, from non-surgeons. One of the reasons that doesn't help you is that generally the surgeons all know each other, or someone in the room will know someone who wrote, who was involved in your letter campaign, but they may not know any people who are psychiatrists or psychologists or pediatricians at a smaller facility. If the person knows you really well, it's still a valuable tool. But if you had to choose between a surgeon that knew you well and a non-surgeon, I would choose a surgeon every time. And all the other thoughts that Brad stated, I agree with. Again, it's really trying. We're trying to figure out who you are, and we use every clue that we can garner to figure that out.
What is the etiquette nowadays with asking for recommendation letters? Are you able to? Is it okay to ask to read them before you submit them, or should they be blind?
Well, I believe they have to be blind. The letter writer may decide to show it to you, but I believe that you sign a waiver saying that you don't have to see them. So the expectation from the applicant should be that they're not going to be able to read the letter, but certainly many letter writers will share the letter they sent in so that you don't feel like this is a cloud of mystery in your application.
Now, I guess it was pretty easy for me during my interviews for residency, as I just showed up in my military uniform. But for those out there who have to actually think about what they're going to wear the next day, what are you expecting to see in a person who shows up to your office and interviewing for a residency, for both males and females?
Yeah, I think that's a fantastic question. Interview day is a formal day. It's a day that you're showing respect for your future career, for the people that are spending time to interview you. And to yourself. So I expect clean clothes, suits, formal wear. I think, you know, any sexuality should be downplayed. I think that that you want to present yourself in a clean, bright manner, that you're going to be the future of medicine for this institution. How would you want your doctor to appear on a formal interview day for the institution? And that's how you should dress.
Yeah, I'd agree with that. I think just suits for men, business suit for women, and you don't want to stick out. You know, there's always bow tie guy, and bow tie guy during the evaluation session kind of becomes bow tie guy.
That's anywhere in life.
Sometimes there's, you know, double ear, you know, hoop earring guy. And the, you know, it's, I'm just speaking honestly when I say that those things will never help you, and for unusual reasons, they could hurt you. It doesn't bother me, but, you know, I've been in the room with multiple different surgeons evaluating applicants, and they get so fixed on, you know, miscellaneous things. You don't want to be a distraction. You know, just be kind of boring and professional.
Yeah, I just want to make a disclaimer that Brad has nothing against bow ties. But, one of my most favorite things, and Howard, I'll start with you on this one, is the mixer the night before. I feel like I could write a book on some of the things that I've seen on the mixer the night before. And to be honest with you, I sometimes feel like candidates and applicants don't realize that, hey, listen, this might be a little bit, we're not sitting across the table from one another, but I'm taking just as much, if not more, away from the way you conduct yourself or the way we can talk. Because we got to spend it for a fellowship or residence. We got to spend a year with you very intimately, or 6 years, 7 years with you. And Howard, what are your thoughts on the mixer before? Should they drink, acting?
Yeah.
What do you wear? All that stuff.
Yeah. Yeah, you made some great points already, even in the introduction to the question. You know, most of the applicants are generally in the same ballpark with regard to scores. They have great letters. They have good personal statements. And what we're really looking for in the overall process is a fit. So I find the cocktail hour the night before is extremely helpful. And just to let you know, the entire process that you're going through as an applicant, everyone is looking at you, not necessarily in a critical way, but you're making an appearance and you're making a presentation from your interaction with the secretarial staff, from the people who work in the hospital. Everyone has the potential to comment on you. So your entire performance is in some way graded. That's not to be too harsh. It's just the reality that you're making a presentation. So things I wouldn't do, I would dress appropriately, a business casual for a Friday night event, for a Saturday interview, or even the event the night before. I wouldn't, again, be too avant-garde with your style of clothing. You can have a drink. I wouldn't have more than one. I would be careful with red wine and tomato sauce and not spilling on yourself. I wouldn't try to be too funny or to tell jokes. I would be true to myself if you're a funny person and you find humor in something. You can obviously use that. We want to try to assess, and the reason they're having that cocktail hour is to kind of get to know you as a person, because, again, like Scott said, we're going to be your family for 5 to 7 years. So we all want to get along, and we want you to like us. But that being said, you always have to be careful how you're presenting yourself to strangers. I don't think it would be a time to discuss politics. I don't think it would be a time to pass judgment on any particular cause. Just be yourself. Try to be comfortable in your own skin. We want to know you for who you are. I don't want you to be phony. And we try very hard not to be anything but who we are. We feel it's really important for you to kind of get to know the residents and the esprit de corps. And that's what we're trying to get across from our perspective. So we're looking for that magic fit. And I would take that opportunity of the cocktail hour or the dinner before to really assess whether you feel like you fit in. And that's what we're doing for you. So be careful and don't skip it. That's the other thing that I see. Occasionally someone has to skip it because a plane got in late, and that's, we understand. But for the most part, if you have the opportunity to attend a social event, I would definitely do it.
Yeah, I would build on that. I agree with all of that completely and wholeheartedly. I think from a mannerism standpoint, I think it's important to be calm and confident. I think it's okay to be appropriately inquisitive about the program, but you don't want it to become the night. So also, it's a little bit about things outside of medicine, in the sense of just casual conversation. You can't hide yourself. That's the problem. So if you're a little bit awkward and, that's not your strength, I think you need to know your weaknesses. So if you're overly gregarious and you've been told, by those close to you, your wife, spouse, whoever, that you talk too much, at times, know that as a weakness and pay attention a little bit to that. If you're perceived as being an introvert, and that could be a turnoff potentially, again, you're not going to dial to the other extreme. You don't have that ability to even, but, understand that that might be a little bit of a weakness to you, and, dig deep to engage, in conversation. I would say I agree with the what Howard said about the don'ts list. Just to add a couple, one is your phone, should be on vibrate and in your pocket. And if you're taking calls, during that, or if the faculty has, is holding court and there's 5 or 6 people listening and they're telling a story and you're texting, you're distracted, you're not focused, that's going to be remembered. So your phone's got to be away. You got 1 hour to 2 hours of your life, unless there's an emergency. And if there's something going on at home that's important or a resident, just calmly apologize and say, hey, I'm really sorry. I got to take this call. I'm actually on call, and it's about a patient from before. But you don't want to be looking on your phone when you're engaging the faculty. Also, all the faculty count. So there might be a program director and a past president of ASCRS in the room, but, the junior faculty or the faculty that nobody knows might be the one when you're scoring the applicants the next day, you've narrowed it down to a few. This has happened frequently, that says, I tried to engage that person last night and couldn't talk to her, couldn't talk to him. Very difficult, socially. And that may be just enough, to push one applicant up or down. So those are just a couple quick points.
Is it important to try to engage everybody in the room? Is it, you know, try to talk to everybody, or just, you know, have meaningful conversations with just a few people?
I think if it's natural, you know, so, you know, you don't want to have that as a goal, because you'll have that on your mind in that sense. And, you know, you'll make conversations shorter. I would try to do that in naturally as you can, and just kind of let it evolve into that, but without forcing it. It's a hard balance. If you're a regular person, be yourself. But again, if you have some weaknesses, try your best to overcome.
Yeah, I think that was a beautiful statement. You don't have to feel like you're working the room, and you certainly don't have to be the funniest person in the room. But you do have to try to make an effort to speak, because the reason that you're coming to the interview and the reason you're coming to the cocktail hour is to get to know people. And if you don't speak at all, it's very hard to get to know someone. So if you are shy, as Brett said, I would try to push it. And shy people are okay. Quiet people are okay. It takes a lot of people to make the world go round. Be true to yourself. But push it if you're shy. And if you're not shy, try to be sincere and represent yourself well. And you don't have to worry about speaking with the chairman or the program director, because as Brett said, everyone in that room has a role in your ultimate acceptance.
I guess we can move on maybe to the interview process now. And obviously the interview is going to be dependent per the program, but is there any prepared questions that, you know, you found that every applicant should have ready when they walk in the room? Should they be more specific to the program or more generalized? How should both a medical student applying to residency and a resident applying to fellowship, you know, approach this?
Well, first, I think preparation for the institution that you're going to is both impressive and actually a necessity. So having prepared for, in our case, Temple University is very nice. If you know that you're in Philadelphia, you know something about Philadelphia, you know something about the program, the leadership of the program, the strengths, the weaknesses, that's all very helpful to you and will help guide your day and question. Let me let Brad go and then I'll continue on.
Yeah, I'd agree with that. I think, you know, understand that in your preparation, the answer is also, you need to have some high quality questions, and you don't want to run out. And I don't think anyone's ranked anyone at the top of their list that finished a 15 minute interview in 12 minutes, that finished a 20 minute interview in 15, a 30 minute interview in 20. You know, you want to engage fully in an enjoyable manner where you both kind of lost track of time. It's a little awkward, you know, when it's silent, and you're going to meet some awkward individuals. I mean, you're going to meet, just because they're faculty surgeons, you know, at X institution, you know, obviously we all know each other and we all have idiosyncrasies too. So to be appropriate to be able to have, you know, engaging questions without sounding like a reporter or an interrogation, but be able to have questions that are appropriate and with a list that doesn't really end. And obviously you're going to want to run into one person that just doesn't want to talk, and then maybe that'll end early, but that should be the exception.
Yeah, I agree. And I think having the interview set up in a manner that you are able, through the course of however many minutes it is, to get across the points that you want to is important. So the questions that you ask let us know what you're thinking about. Most people will also want to talk about themselves. So even if you were to run out of questions, an answer of how you became interested to the faculty in their specialty, how you became interested in the university where you are, did you think when you were an applicant that you were going to end up where you were? What were your dreams when you were applying? Who were your role models? I mean, you could start to think out of the box, talking about surgery, but trying to get to know someone a little bit better as well, because you're really assessing the faculty member as much as they're assessing you. I wouldn't ask questions that might be sensitive to a particular program. If you're interviewing at a rural program, You might not want to ask, do you see enough of this case or that case? And try to learn those facts from the course of the day, maybe speaking to residents carefully. But I wouldn't directly assess what you think might be a weakness, because it might be a little bit sensitive. So I would just be careful with some of the questions that you theoretically could ask as well.
Yeah, I think you have to learn how to sell yourself without being arrogant. And a hard balance, but you should practice. You get to practice with your spouses, practice with your own program directors, digressing a little bit. But I think it's really important to mock interviews, you know, if this is new to you, before you go anywhere. And because, you know, one question I always ask that I find that people struggle with, I say, you know, you're highly qualified. Everyone in the room has the same scores. They all have great letters. They're all hardworking people. They're all personable. And they've all published. They all have drive. Tell me, in a short interaction with you that I have, what really separates you, you know, put you in the top tier, you know, from the pack, not knowing the others in the room, but tell me a little more. And people struggle with that. They come back with, I'll work harder. That, you know, they say the things that I just said right back. And they said, okay. And they struggle to do that. And I want them to. I want them to be a little proud, you know, in that moment. And I really want them to get something out in front of me that's going to be, that's true and sincere. And, that, you know, I can call up their program director. I've seen that in their letter. But I just want to kind of, you know, hear that they think they're unique. Because we all think a lot of our own programs. So we want you to think a lot of yourself, you know, in your ability to come here and find that perfect fit.
Dr. Ross, I've heard of, you know, especially for the med students applying to residencies, that at some programs they will, you know, almost try and pimp in sessions on interviews. I think it's probably less common, but do you have any tough questions that you ask interviewees? And what kind of questions do you see med students kind of underselling themselves?
Well, we don't have any pimp questions, and I don't know anyone in surgery education that does. Maybe in the days of the Giants, it was more of a weeding out process. But to be honest, the interview day for us in surgery and in medicine is so inspiring to see how bright everyone is. And when people worry about the future of American surgery, you go to an interview day, probably at any general surgery residency in the United States, you're going to come out energized and impressed, because the kids going into surgery are mind-blowing in how prepared they are, mature they are, dedicated to service. So it's really a good day for everyone, and quite fun for us. And we certainly don't pimp anyone. We come out there impressed, just blown away by the quality of the entire group. So no, we don't pimp at all. Occasionally, you know, it's interesting. You spend all this time on your application, and you'll put down five publications or abstracts. Whatever you put down, you have to be able to talk about. And I think a negative point that we sometimes see is you can't discuss the research that they've listed as an author, and that's quite bad. So you want to know that what you put down is on there. It is understood by you.
I think there's a little bit of an indirect pimping that I usually find myself engaged in at a fellowship level. And, you know, sometimes I'll use on the publication part rather than hear, you know, occasionally I'll ask about, you know, one of the publications and just to talk about what they got out of that project. And then I'll kind of parlay that into, and, you know, for instance, it was about rectal cancer. And it's obvious that you spend a lot of time with colorectal surgeons, you know, by your rotations, and we've talked about that, and you had a retrospective review or something. I'll say, so, you know, how is everyone approaching, you know, low rectal cancer at your institution? Just to see. And so it's a little bit of it's just more of inquisitive, but I want to hear that applicant on a subspecialty level talk more intelligently, you know, than the average PGY4 that's not going into colorectal surgery. And I want to hear, you know, how well they can speak, and do they think in an algorithmic fashion? Are they paying attention you know, to what their own mentors and faculty are doing in their own specialty at their own institution. And are they intrigued by that? Do they get excited about that when they're explaining it? You know, or can they not answer that question? So that's, I think, just make sure you know your specialty, obviously, in and out.
So, guys, as we wrap this up, I think it's important we touch on a few other things, and probably one of them is, and again, Howard, I'll start with you, is give me a list of don'ts. If you could really boil it down and give some things, you know, we covered a little bit about this, but what are the don'ts, what are the do's throughout the whole interview process that you would just say, you know, you're standing there at the scrub sink, your resident's getting ready to go on an interview, or your med student's getting ready to go on an interview, and you just want to hit them with some quick things. Hey, remember, when you go on that interview, do this, don't do that.
Yeah, I guess when you ask about don'ts, I'd say don't be rude at all to anyone. Don't be unprepared. Don't try to be something that you're not. And those are the big things. I would say do try to be yourself. Do try to be comfortable in your own skin and relax. And do be very proud of all that you've accomplished to get where you are. Because, again, most of the time, if you've made it to that interview room, you are on equal footing as everyone else, and now's just the time to assess fit, you to them and them to you, and the whole process is to allow that interaction to happen and see where you belong.
Yeah, I'd agree with all those don'ts. I think the one other one to consider is, you know, you have 15 or 20 minutes. You know, understand what that means. So if they ask your first question in the door, this happens more than you know. I've had answers that take 14 of those 15 minutes from applicants. So, you know, really preparation in your answers is important. And understand that if you start to digress, you know, it's a slippery slope, and if there's a little nerves that are kicking in, and you may all of a sudden start talking 5, 7, 8, 9, 10 minutes. And as you're talking and talking and talking, the faculty member is liking you less and less and less. They may just let you keep talking because they've made up their mind that there's not going to be much more to ask after that. You know, so I would just have, you know, appropriate answers, but learn to tie them up and move on to the next point, you know, in that sense. I mean, as far as do's, I agree. I think, you know, it's really important to, you know, kind of have an appropriate confidence, you know, about you. Make sure you're affable. It's a fine line. You know, you really want to get your strengths out there without selling like a salesman. So if that's the art of it, it's getting them to know what's special about you and why you might be a great fit for them without selling it to them. It just takes preparation.
Dr. Russ, one question I have for you is students that, they always wonder, should I do away rotations? Is that going to increase my chance? And maybe the student that doesn't have quite the board scores or something, would an away rotation at your institution help their chances?
I would say in general that away rotations, if you can do them, are helpful in a number of fronts, both for the applicant and for the program. So from your perspective, you're going to get to know people a lot better. You're going to be able to accurately assess the environment where you plan to spend the next 5 to 7 years. You're going to see the true spirit of the residents to each other, the attendings to the residents, the entire hospital staff to each other. So it's an excellent way to really get to assess a program. From our perspective, not only are we flattered if you come, but we also get a chance to work with you closely and really know what the product that we're striving to recruit is. What is the product exactly? So it's very helpful. But, you know, if you don't do it, it's certainly not a negative. It's expensive. It's time away from family, friends, your home institution. So it's clearly not a requirement. But I think it can help you. You also can only do it at one or maybe two programs. So clearly you'd have to prioritize where you did this. But I think it can be a good thing.
You know, moving on the interview process, the one question that a lot of people have is when you get back to your home institution, what about thank you letters? Do you handwrite these or do you email them?
Yeah, that's a great point. I like the romance of getting a handwritten letter, I think it shows a little bit of extra thoughtfulness. However, in the world of email, the thank you note that's written on email is rapidly forwarded. What's interesting, though, is that if you write the same letter to four different faculty on email, and then they all get sent to the program director, they immediately all show up as exactly the same. So there's pluses and minuses to the email. I don't think either is better or worse, but I would say the romantic in me likes the handwritten note.
I think the second point is critical. You know, we're in a generation of email. I don't think it's going to make a difference between two applicants. So I think email's okay, but I would personalize it, you know, and make it a little bit shorter, you know, kind of a long-winded generic email sent to everyone. It's obviously, it depersonalizes the message. So I think it can be short and sweet, but I would make them different to the different faculty.
Howard, as we close up here, just two quick questions. The first one is, especially for the medical students out there, should they be leery of places that have interim chairs or interim program directors in place or rapid turnover of the staff? Is that a worrisome thing at all, or does it depend on the institution or the history behind the institution? And what about these newer residencies, ones that are just getting going up? Any thoughts there?
Well, I think you've answered the question as you ask it. Obviously, you have to know the history of why there is an interim chair. Sometimes it means absolutely nothing. The chair left, retired, took a different position, and now there's an interim chair. It doesn't mean that the program's not absolutely excellent and that there's a long tradition of surgical excellence in education. I wouldn't blink once to hesitate to apply to that program. I would say if you get to a program and you find out that three-quarters of the faculty has left in the last 2 years, it might be a hint that there's something unstable about the program. So I think you have to keep your eyes open on both fronts. Neither is a black mark. Certainly the interim chair or interim program director in an institution that has a long history, I wouldn't worry about it. But if it looks like the entire institution is imploding, then you have to take that. And you'll probably pick that up in the attitude and interaction of the residents and faculty and hospital staff as well. So you'd be able to see it. And your second question was what, Scott?
Just if there was any problems with in terms of the interim chairs you covered. Brad, your thoughts on that stuff?
Yeah, I think it's, I don't want to steal Howard's thunder, but I think it's more important on that level, you know, with the general surgery, but depends who the program director is, depends who the core faculty are. You know, I think who's doing the training, you know, is more important, you know, in that sense, and what the culture is there when you're going. And really, just figure out who the ones that are doing the training. Talk to the former residents, the current residents, or former fellows. And as long as that core is there that are really doing the training, that's more important than anything.
Dr. Ross, I wanted to finish up with one final question. And there's a lot of international students that are listening to Behind the Knife now, and every year there's many international applicants applying for general surgery. What advice do you give to these medical students that want to join a program in the United States?
I'd say it's the same in some large part as those that are American students. Get as good test scores as you can. Try to apply to as many programs as you can handle that are appropriate to your background, and take every opportunity you can to get into a program. That's my answer.
Okay, guys, as we normally do our final five, but we'll wind up with the final one. And Brad, I'm going to start off with you. So if you could go back in time and visit yourself on your first day of internship or your first day, you know, just starting it out, what piece of advice would you give to yourself?
As a general surgery intern?
Yeah, as a general surgery intern. You can go back and there you are. It's day one. You're in Albany.
Yeah, so I think something I learned, throughout the first year, was to, when it comes to doing your assignments, do it now. you know, do it yourself, trust no one, and take names. Howard? Yeah, that's so funny. I remember my first day so clearly. I was there, I had my new coat. I thought I was a superstar. I got called from the nurse that a patient had a headache and wanted Tylenol. I said, hold on, I'll call you back. I hung up the phone. I looked up the toxic dose of Tylenol. I looked at myself in the mirror. I said, you can do this. And I went out to the floor. I said, okay, you can have 2 Tylenol. And I wrote the order. So I think it's important to try to enjoy every day. I like John Lennon's quote that life is what happens when you're busy making plans. So I would try to enjoy residency. But I would also tell you that most of your life is not your residency and is not your fellowship, but is your career. So try to put a lot of thought in early as to what you think the optimal career is and why you think that. Is it because your mother always told you you'd be the president of the American College of Obstetrics and Gynecology, or do you really want to do something for some other reason? Whose idea is it? Why are you having that idea? And what do you really want from life? And I think if you do that, you'll have a much more satisfying career. And it's really the career that you're interested in, not so much the residency or the fellowship. But clearly, since every day is important, those are important days.
Yeah, I guess I would. I would say if I had to give my as making an old reference actually to that, to an old chief resident, you know, that I had with their rules. But if I had to go back and, you know, advise myself on, you know, I think it would be understanding the importance of team. And, you know, that's, you come through medical student, you're not really on a team. You've been on teams in sports and you've learned from that, or you haven't, and maybe in other jobs in your life. But this is probably your first major professional team that dramatically can impact people's lives and their health and their outcomes in surgery. And so I think it's your first exposure to how teams work well. And keep your eyes open and pay a lot of attention to the teams that work well, the leaders that lead well, and the ones that don't. And then the leadership skills you do and do not desire to have, you know, through your chiefs and your attending. So I would learn learn both, you know, from your positive and negative role models all the way through, and try to understand that it takes a lot of people, you know, to deliver exceptional care. And you may not see the big picture, but do your job, you know, extremely well. And, you know, there's a lot to be said just for that.
Well, gentlemen, thank you so much for joining us. I know, obviously, as we talked about right in the beginning, that, you know, individual results may vary, whether it be the program director or the actual program. But I think a lot of the lessons that you talked about tonight were invaluable, and I hope that the listeners of BTK can really take it to heart. So thank you much, and have a wonderful evening.
Thanks, guys. Thanks. Thank you. Really appreciate being on here.
Until next time, dominate the day.